This week on Decentralize.
Google Fiber, gigabit internet for Atlanta residents.
Then later, we'll talk with Bitcoin girl Naomi Brockwell.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Welcome, everyone, to Decentralize episode 18. I'm here with my co-hosts Tony Sakic and Eric Martindale, and we have some exciting news. Actually, in Atlanta, where we're all based, Google Fiber has announced unrolling of its gigabit internet for Atlanta residents. We're really interested in what Google Fiber means for internet access in the United States and actually abroad. How do you guys feel about this for yourselves in Atlanta and about Google Fiber in general?
Awesome. There's really nothing that can be said besides that. I think everyone's equally as excited. It was funny because when it was made, the announcement, I was in San Francisco with nearby someone from Austin who was speaking very highly of the service. So I don't think that we're going to be let down. I think waiting is going to be the hardest part, like Tom Petty said. But I also think it's going to cause all of the competition to reduce their prices as well. It's going to be great, and I think this is something that needs to happen around the country in a lot of large cities so we can improve broadband access for everyone.
Yeah, I'm excited about the whole increasing broadband access for everyone, but I'm really not excited about another centralized provider coming into the space. It kind of saddens me to see that thought isn't going into how do you make this a decentralized non-issue, right? Where if you can figure out the tech, if a company the size of Google has as much engineering resources as they do, why don't they put thought into how to incentivize people or how to build a proper mesh network so that this never becomes an issue again? And that's really what kind of saddens me. And I'm sure that where that actually is going to come from is going to be like a developer, just sort of building on his own. I mean, BitPay has been working on Foxtrot. There's a lot of work being put into CJDNS. There's Freenet. These projects are out there, and Google Fiber, yeah, well, great, and it's going to bring fast internet and let a lot of people in Atlanta download their WorldStar videos much faster. That's great, but it's not the answer, the decentralized answer that I've been looking for. So for me, it's sort of a nonplussed, but it's pursuant to the goals of increasing access to information. So
the goal should be how to decentralize WorldStar. We need to figure that out so we can get our videos, the fighting and ratchetness, in all presented, in a decentralized manner. But yeah, in general, I think it's exciting, and obviously it's easy to say that as you're going to have one. I'm happy Comcast isn't our choice, but this is going to end up being a footnote versus as big as it seems now. Whereas I'm pretty sure there's probably some technology just growing, like Eric just mentioned with Foxtrot and CJDNS, where there's going to be a new way to route internet traffic. That's something you may not hear about all of a sudden, but the gains are happening right now, and they're happening behind the scenes. They're just not getting as much press as things like Google Fiber because, for one, Google's brand name, It's really that's another one, too. When you come in with that name, it really, makes a bigger deal. You have a bigger machine behind you. Even if you don't want to spend a cent on publicizing it, people are going to publicize it for you because of the brand you have, and lucky for them, really. But and it comes into net neutrality and that being an issue. It's one of those things where I don't necessarily think there's going to be one answer to this problem, but there are going to be a lot of little answers, and eventually those will find an answer, and that will be some kind of mesh networking solution, much like what's happening in Cuba right now. I really encourage all of our listeners to research that, and I did just some light reading on it. Didn't really go in depth or anything, but enough, read a couple interesting articles, I think, from Wired, and I forgot, another one might have been on Motherboard, just about the way that that's existing in Cuba, and it's really existing mostly for video games, not to create some kind of rebellious dissent, rather than just to talk to loved ones and friends and play some games, which is really, to me, the most important thing, because that's, who's around you. So it's going to be an interesting long road, and I don't think anyone's going to be able to predict what steps are going to happen next.
How do you think we incentivize companies like Google to sort of look into mesh networking and these kind of decentralized solutions? Is there a way to do that, or do you think the incentives are too strongly aligned to provide something like Fiber, which, I think is probably pretty awesome, it's giving internet access to pretty much everyone in the city. It definitely will have far-reaching effects, but may have far-reaching effects for the negative as well.
You build it. That's how you get them to look into it. You go ahead and build it and start competing with them. You force them to basically look into ways of doing this that are at a lower cost. I mean, you simply cannot compete with a mesh network. It's just going to be cheaper, and the service will be better. And that's, you can't build a centralized service that's better than it. So you build it.
If you build it, they will come. And especially because of the nature of it, it would probably be a lot cheaper. So, you know, that's another way you can expand that. And, you know, it's going to be many interesting things. And, you know, I think one of the topics we wanted to talk about a little bit, I'm going to actually let you introduce it, because it was something that you brought up, James, was about AdYen and Bitcoin. And I think that the evolution of Bitcoin and who accepts it is really an interesting thing that almost parallels this, but in the opposite way, because everything here is done in the open, where you're seeing a decentralized service being introduced to these large corporations and companies versus, you know, what's happening with someone probably tinkering in their basement in order to decentralize internet access. But James, speak a little bit more about AdYen, because you know more about that topic than I do right now.
Yeah, so AdYen is one of the big payment service providers out there, and they're actually making it possible through BitPay now for companies like Facebook and Spotify to pretty much seamlessly activate Bitcoin payments, and that's a pretty significant step. I mean, obviously, when you first, you know, encountered Bitcoin, it came around, merchant adoption was extremely difficult. I mean, like, to actually, like, integrate this into your business, into your normal point of sale and everything, let alone for large enterprise merchants and online merchants, whereas now, you know, it's really as simple as pretty much flipping a switch. And that's going to be very significant, I think, for whether these companies adopt it. But I'm wondering, actually, whether y'all think companies like Facebook and Spotify will adopt Bitcoin at any point in the future, and what do you think the timeline would be? What obstacles do you think we would see to sort of that happening now that it's so easy, relatively speaking?
I think there's a lot of them. I've never actually once given Facebook a penny of my own money. So I really can't speak on that. I know they monetize their product in many, many ways, but I can't speak on that. For Spotify, however, I think Bitcoin really, actually, even more behind the scenes than just for payment for their service, Bitcoin has tons of options. And I know that there have been conversations with folks, you know, from, I can't think of the name of the organization, but they handle the royalties. And same with Spotify, you know, the micropayments, the microtransactions really are built for Bitcoin. And that entire backend is something I'm surprised Spotify hasn't researched a lot more. It really could be a way for them to save a lot of money and increase payouts, which is something you're hearing a lot of artists complain about. That's where I think the Bitcoin technology is going to be most valuable for Spotify. Obviously, this deal seems to only give them the option of accepting, but I hope they both turn it on very soon, because I'm a longtime Spotify subscriber and I'd love to be able to pay with Bitcoin. And I do think it's behind the scenes for the royalties that, you know, micropayments and Bitcoin, that's where it's going to be killer in music. What do you think, Eric?
I think that there's a very compelling use case right now for accepting Bitcoin, or a very compelling reason. Let me invert that. There's no compelling reason not to be accepting Bitcoin, because, first of all, companies, every payment out there, processor out there now does it for free. Most payment processors do it for free, right? And the implementation is so simple that there really should be no overhead to implementing it. Now, the question is, where does it fall on the priority list of some of these larger companies, right? So if you're a Facebook or a Spotify, you know, you've got, you know, 15 other things in your development pipeline. How do you prioritize accepting Bitcoin as one of them, right? Yeah, it's still a task. It's a small task, but it's still a task. I don't think it's going to happen until there's really a strong consumer demand for it. And since Bitcoin's killer app is not payment networks, it's all of the things you can do as a result of the solution to the Byzantine generals problem, like databases and communication networks and just being able to keep a record of history. It's not necessarily about finance. Finance just happens to be the first application of these things. It's once those things start getting built out, then they're going to start thinking about, like, maybe accepting Bitcoin. But I really view accepting Bitcoin as being so low in importance in relation to the grander scale of things. And when I say grander scale, I mean, you know, the next, you know, 20, 100, 200 years. like, these things are being built right now. The fact that Bitcoin is being used as a currency is just sort of a precursor. So only when there's going to be a strong consumer demand, and I don't necessarily think it's going to happen until major nation states begin collapsing, which is going to happen. So,
speaking of major nation states collapsing, millennials. Actually, I think they would be the strongest use case for this, actually, from a consumer side. And we've been saying for a while that if we actually see any consumer demand in the near future, it will be from young people who don't have access to credit cards. And those young people are the same users of Spotify and Facebook. So if you're able, you know, as a young person, basically have an online digital payment method, you're able to buy content from Facebook or whatever, this could really be a strong case for that, a strong use case for the consumers. But yeah, I think it's a few years down the road. We'll see about that. But as a young buck myself, I'm afraid I don't know too much about our next topic. I'm looking forward to hearing from you and Tony about that, Eric. Tell us a little bit about bulletin board systems and the ancient days of the internet.
Bulletin boards, man. So when I was sort of growing up, there wasn't really a strong World Wide Web, right? World Wide Web is where you actually open a browser and you type in a web address and you get served up some content by some server somewhere. Now we start talking about, you know, Bitcoin and, you know, how do you pay for that content and what are you actually paying for, what are you paying with. With Facebook, Tony, you mentioned earlier that you've never paid them a cent of your money. Yeah, but every second of the time that you give them, that is something that they sell. Like literally every moment your eyeball is looking at a Facebook product, that is what they sell to advertisers. And the advertisers buy that from Facebook. Facebook's just a broker. Before that model sort of emerged, the World Wide Web, before there was a really strong web presence, the internet itself existed just the same. And people could spin up, you know, these little servers that didn't speak hypertext, but if you could get the address of that server, you could literally dial into that server, right? You would call the phone number and connect to the modem at the end of that phone number. And it would stream you data over your terminal. And you would download parts of documents and navigate the system. And based on what keys you would press, you know, it would navigate you through the interface. The term bulletin board came to be where the sort of democratic model of being able to submit information into the bulletin board for all of the others to see and respond to eventually was really where that came from. And, you know, we got linked to some really cool resurgent ideas about this, and it's a really old concept. But you start thinking about the internet again as opposed to the World Wide Web. They are very distinctive concepts. And sort of pursuing some of the projects that we've been working on and a lot of people are working on now that they're thinking about decentralization, you're starting to see a lot of people spinning up their own servers for the web, sure. But also there are services that are sort of spinning up that you can connect to. For example, the Blinkin' Lights server serves up, when you connect to it, an ASCII art version of Star Wars, right? And there is absolutely no reason for there to be concentrated densities of these servers like we have on the web today, where there is a very small subset of highly valued content providers like Facebook, like Google. Most of the traffic gets routed to Google, YouTube. Now we can sort of spread that out, and individuals can become publishers themselves. And yeah, they're doing that on the web with, you know, building your own web page, but now they're starting to do it with services. And Spotify is a good example of this breaking into the music industry, but we're still crammed into the World Wide Web and hypertext, HTTP. But I think that we're going to start seeing a little bit of a spread out from that. It really, anytime we talk about this stuff, it brings me back to the days of like being able to dial into a MUD, which is a multi-user dungeon, and play a video game in a modern-day MMORPG, but adventure. Like every step would be something new and exciting because it changed all the time. The world was shaped by the other players that would be playing the game, and as a kid, that was amazing to me. It was just like, it was the most fascinating thing. And then once, that's really what got me into learning technology and computers in general, was dialing into these worlds and exploring them and wanting to build one of my own, right? And I think that speaks to why, you know, sort of BBSs and sort of other services other than just simple web pages are important is because it really captures the imagination of the individual. Because it captured mine as a kid, and I can see what drives people to learn technology is really the opportunity to create. And I think that is the single most important thing that we can do in our life, is to spend our time to create rather than to consume. So, just my thoughts.
Hey, and as a follow-up to that, obviously, here, I want to give you a standing ovation for your speech. It was great, and I agreed. It was something that interested me as a kid. My very first experience with the Internet was experiencing something, bulletin board system, in school. And it was in first or second grade. I don't remember the year, but I remember the experience, and I don't remember understanding any of the technical jargon. I was a gamer, so I had a little bit of knowledge of like hardware, but not much more than that. And I thought the idea that you could use the phone to contact something however many miles away and learn about whatever you wanted to learn about was just the neatest thing. You know, obviously I learned it later in life and it all came to be, but what was cool about this is a mutual friend, which we will name drop, Shooter Jennings, sent us one called Bit Sunrise, and you figured out what it was much quicker than I did, Eric, because I recommended you to follow it per his recommendation, and here we are playing on it. I played on it for about an hour. I think you played longer, and we're just messing around with all this software that was, what, 30 years old? And maybe not that old, but 20 years old at least, and just having a good time, and kind of it reminded me of learning about all this and, you know, your first experiences with everything to do with the Internet and your and everything to do with all that. And, you know, as a follow-up to the other thing you were speaking on about Spotify, I think Spotify actually, well, while we were talking about them a moment ago, they're full of missed opportunities. What MySpace wanted to be is what Spotify should be, which is a place for artists to really not just gather their fan base, but to gather their fan base and communicate with them. There really isn't a way for artists to communicate with their fan bases easily. You can do it, but really the interface is not that hot, and it really is a built-in way to make that happen so smoothly. And it could be a way to sell tickets, it could be a way to sell merchandise. I don't see these ingrained well much, and so when you were speaking of things like Spotify that need to provide alternate ways to get information, I think that specialization is good via the kind of file it is versus the kind of art it is, whatever the following may be, but just really, you know, making sure that they all take advantage of everything that they have given to them when they have all those artists, or they have all that control in that audience rather than the artists, is really important. I was definitely, you know, fascinated by the entire thing last week, though, about BBS systems, and I think it's funny how that got you into the Internet the same way that music did for me, and that's why I follow these topics like Spotify so closely to this day, even though things like Bitcoin to me are much more interesting now. So with that being said, I did want to hop this over to James. What got you interested in the Internet? This is a cold question, but I think it's something you can easily answer. What got you interested in? How did you get to this point where, you know, you're in a tech podcast, you know?
Oh, man, that's a fascinating story and a great question. It's so funny, you know, I'm traditionally really interested in philosophy and economics, and I probably would not have considered myself a quote-unquote tech person until, you know, probably about a year or so ago. But seeing all the wonderful things we can, you know, gain from technology, both in terms of economic benefit and just sort of individual freedom and individual thought and expression, has really excited me. Obviously, Bitcoin's been a great part of that. These media platforms have been a great part of that. And it's been a wonderful journey, and I'm really glad to be a part of this. Because I do think there's so much we can all learn from it, and I do think this is going to be the medium we all interact with, no matter what our interests are. So whether you're a philosopher, an economist, an actor, a musician, or a CEO, you're going to be interacting with it, and you should kind of discover how great things can be with the Internet. And, you know, honestly, the early days sound excellent. The early days of the Internet with these BBS systems, I think it'd be really cool to explore how we can bring some of these things back if they're really going to be helpful for the cause of decentralization or just for understanding, you know, the tools we're using. But, you know, going back to your question sort of about sort of these media platforms, I'm really excited about talking to our next guest, Naomi Brockwell, sort of about her work in decentralization and kind of explaining these ideas through media, through film, and I'm really excited about talking to her. She's been doing a lot of great work there. So we're going to go ahead and transition over to that, but it's been good talking to you all this week.
All right, so we are here today with Naomi Brockwell. who is the CEO and founder of Rainsworth Productions, producer at the Motion Picture Institute, a policy associate at New York City Bitcoin Center, and the creator and host of BitcoinGirl.org. She's also the executive producer of the upcoming feature film Subconscious. Naomi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is going to be fun.
Absolutely. So just to get us started, you've got a really impressive list of things that you're doing, and it really spans a lot of areas. But you're pretty much well known in the decentralized community as Bitcoin Girl. Can you tell us a little bit about that idea and how you came about it?
Right. Well, that was a little bit ridiculous, actually. People were claiming all these names all over the place. It was a lot earlier in Bitcoin's history, and no one had really claimed Bitcoin Girl, so I thought, why not? So I just set up a website and whatnot, and then I was very interested in Bitcoin. I love Austrian economics, so for me, Bitcoin was just a fantastic example of a working currency that is decentralized, that isn't controlled by a central authority like a government. I thought that was pretty fantastic, so I just fell in love with it. And then Bitcoin Girl actually became a vehicle for me to educate people about the technology. So, I mean, I'm not a tech head myself, but I do sort of work in the circles a lot. So I know more than your average bear about Bitcoin, and I find that, you know, there's been such a negative bias in the mainstream media against Bitcoin that I thought someone really should go about trying to turn that tide and actually educate people, teach them this is something like an incredible technology that people should be very excited about and it's in their best interests. So that was my aim with this. I wanted to interview people in the space. I wanted to let them know why Bitcoin is exciting. And if I could be that mediator between the people who are incredibly technically savvy and excited about the technology and those who really don't understand it and who are giving it a bad name, I wanted to re-educate and inform people.
And what has the response been so far to your efforts to educate through Bitcoin Girl and through your other projects?
Well, it really depends on the person. So I think that the Bitcoin community in general tends to be pretty positive about the efforts. They like the fact that there are people out there trying to get people on board. You know, they're excited about this. They want to see more people involved with this community. On the other side of things, I am constantly getting into fights with people who are very uneducated about the technology, but who, you know, insist on trying to convince me why it's this terrible idea, why it can't work, why it isn't working, why we're enabling criminals to run rife through society. So I'm constantly having discussions with these people about this. So that's it's also interesting for me. I mean, the United States is, and especially New York, I live in New York, it's very open-minded about this. They're much more on board than the rest of the world, I think. And I really discovered that last time I went back to Australia. And I would talk to people about Bitcoin, and some of my friends back there would say, like, what is this thing? I really don't understand it. And I try to explain it to them, and you could see they just shut off. Whereas most people I talk with here in New York communities, they're very interested. They want to know more. It's a lot more in the news. Australians haven't yet jumped on board with this yet. So we should see that hopefully soon.
Great. So sort of like as you're talking to people, like I've noticed people fall into like two camps. You know, it's the people who don't quite understand it will argue against it.
Yeah.
And then it seems like once they dive down the rabbit hole, they start to read about it and learn about it, and then suddenly they become, you know, real supporters of it. What's been in your experience, like, that process? How does that take place?
I definitely have found that the difference is education, and I've written a few op-eds about this. That, you know, I mean, it tells you something when some of the smartest people in the world are throwing millions into this technology. You know, if Bill Gates goes to the press and says this is incredible technology, guys, take note of this, and you're going to say, well, I think I know the tech space better than Bill Gates. I think that if someone like that says this is something to be interested in, it should put up a flag to at least be a little bit curious, at least look into it a little bit more before you slam it back down. I've definitely seen that the difference is education. I recently spoke at a ManCal event. They're an organization in Australia Korea that educates people about economics. And during that talk, I had a guy, you know, I was talking mainly about Bitcoin. It's a big passion of mine. And I had this guy give this incredible rebuttal to me, and he thought he was very intelligent and put his hand up, and this happens all the time. These people who've thought about the questions, the hard questions they can get you with, and he said, now listen, you've given a good talk tonight, but let me just try something. I'm going to ask the audience how many people actually own Bitcoin. And so he asked the audience, and I think one person put their hand up, two, including myself, and he says to me, there you go. And I asked him, so what were you proving there? Are you saying that because the technology hasn't yet lifted off that it's not worthwhile? If you were to ask people at the advent of the internet how many people had the internet and you had one person put their hand up, are you going to then condemn it and say this is not a worthwhile idea? Because I mean, that just slaps all the wonderful technologies in the face from history. So yeah, I do get a lot of people arguing from a point of an uninformed position.
I think you're right with every technology that happens, especially if it's challenging something that has existed for hundreds of years that people have been taught and it's ingrained mm-hmm. in their psyche that money works this way. You go to the bank, yeah. You get money. You know, it really is challenging everything. So I that doesn't surprise me necessarily. But what did surprise me when I got into the Bitcoin space officially, because I was someone who worked in a completely different industry and really got attracted to this and eventually got a job in it after a year or two of being a fan, and I noticed that there's a lot more women involved than I would assume just from, you know, reading the R Bitcoin subreddit and Bitcoin Talk, which are the big places on the internet for discussions. And you still get I still hear this, and it's less often than it was a year ago, but I still hear there's not that many women involved. It's just a bunch of, you know, 20-something guys. And for the most part, it's true, but there is more women than I feel is represented by the media. How do we reach that demographic better? How do we make it so the Bitcoin space is something that they feel comfortable in participating in, that, you know, that they're interested in, and what are some things that you think really need to happen, not just by, and this really isn't by any centralized Bitcoin, like the Bitcoin Foundation, but more from the businesses that are building this economy? What do they need to do to reach out to this and change this a little bit so the percentage isn't 80-20 or 85-15, it's more like 50-50 or 60-40?
Right. Well, I mean, that's a tough question. You could say the same thing about computer science or engineering, or, you know, I think men and women have different interests. And also, I think, I mean, there are not many people you can get excited about a currency. It's not like I can go out there and be like, hey, guys, US dollar, get excited about it. Like, I mean, it's just a thing you use, right? You know.
Well, I'll say this. How many rap songs are about the US dollar? The US dollar is incredibly well marketed. Everyone knows that, you know, it's all about that green. There's symbols that mean it. Like, the marketing for the U.S. dollar, which I think was almost all done just coincidentally, is great. I'm a big fan of, I think the industry leaders in Bitcoin need to get together and pick a brand for Bitcoin, a logo that everyone uses. But that's just ranting off, but I do think the U.S. dollar is well-marketed, actually.
I think it's futile. I think it's redundant is a better word, though, because the U.S. dollar is mandated. Right. There is absolutely no reason for someone to accept the U.S. dollar as currency if it wasn't mandated, because it's going to be worth less the next day than when you accepted it. There is no reason for people to accept it. That's what, you know, centralized banking, that's what inflation does. Bitcoin, on the other hand, has incredible advantages for people. So if you were to try and market it, you would, you know, talk to those advantages. The gender difference, I mean, I don't know how you overcome that. Honestly, I think that, in my opinion, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who just know so much more about this than I do, but in my opinion, it's the vendors who will really make this pick up. If we can get more vendors to accept Bitcoin, then it will give, you know, it will increase the number of people that are using it. It's only when things become really popular that you hit that critical mass. I know that sounds like a catch-22, but I think it's just going to stay on the fringes until we get more vendors on board, and then it will just become something that you hear about everywhere. Overstock is using it. Amazon will use it. eBay is you know, on the brink of getting involved with that more heavily. All of that really helps the branding of Bitcoin because it makes it seem mainstream, it makes it seem safe. People don't want to swap out their US dollars that have been marketed so well for something that they don't know too much about. So the more we can get it into larger vendors, the more we can get it in a positive light into the media, the better it will be.
And I think you bring a very interesting and unique perspective to Bitcoin with your background really in media and in acting and producing. How did you first become, attracted to this sort of field for your talents? And how has this really informed your work in Bitcoin and your interest in Bitcoin? Would you say your acting and your producing?
Well, I actually didn't get into Bitcoin through the acting and producing. I started out in economics, and that's sort of my basis. And I'm a big fan of Austrian economics, and I actually fell in love with Bitcoin because I'm very interested in monetary policy. I'm very interested in centralized banking, in fiat currencies, and exploring different currencies. So that's how I fell in love with Bitcoin. But it is interesting to see some analogies that can be made between the movie industry as it is today and currency. I think the world is on the brink of a very peer-to-peer paradigm, and it's very exciting. You know, applications like Uber, fantastic. Airbnb, fantastic. 3D printing, all of these things which take control out of centralized bodies and disperse it, decentralize it, if you will. I think that it's an exciting time, and I think that, you know, you've seen that in the film industry. You've seen the distribution methods completely change. It's no longer a big player's game. Anyone can make a film. I mean, we walk around with a with an HD camera in our smartphone. So it's very easy for you to make a high quality film these days, to have high quality editing equipment. It really doesn't cost much at all. So anyone can do that, and that's exciting. And I really like the way that you don't need too much capital to be able to go into this field. There's not too much of a barrier to entry. And distribution platforms like YouTube, I mean, that has completely revolutionized the film industry. Quite often, you can watch feature films on YouTube now, and they're free, and they're made by people who are, you know, showing a unique perspective to the world, not necessarily a studio which is hindered by certain special interests, you know. So that's exciting, and you see the same in currency. You know, Bitcoin is a peer-to-peer technology. It takes the control away from government, away from central banks. In fact, like just this afternoon, I had a meeting with a guy who's just created a new app. I think it's called Currency.io, if I remember that correctly. But it's fascinating because, I mean, he's looking at exchange rates and the fact that when you go to Australia, you know, you are paying a difference on the exchange rate. You're going to be paying, let's say for every $100, you're going to be paying $22 in fees, or you're going to be losing $22 when you exchange it. And then you have some time in Australia, and when you come back, you're going to convert your Australian dollars back to US dollars, you're going to lose, you know, another $22 or whatnot. So what if we could find people who had Australian dollars and US dollars and just connect them in a decentralized way? If we knew where they were and we met up face to face and just exchanged the dollars for dollars, according to whatever the exchange rate is. Like, that's fantastic to me, because no longer does it have to go through centralized banking. No longer do you have to deal with the monopolies that you find when you go to the airport and there's just like one exchange that you deal with, so they can charge whatever prices they want. This is an amazing decentralized system. So I was very excited to learn about that. I'll probably interview him in the next few weeks to learn more about this. But yeah, especially for someone like myself, you know, I do a lot of traveling, and this just sounds fantastic, that I don't have to, you know, give up a lot of my money in payments and fees.
That's absolutely true, and you're hitting on something that's really close and dear to a lot of our hearts here. Anytime you see sort of the accessibility of publishing platforms increase, or the bandwidth of information transfer increasing. So, for example, you can go all the way back to when speech was first developed, when written language was first developed, up to the Gutenberg printing press, right? It increases the flow of information and communication. And Napster and the internet and all of this, these models are rapidly changing. And you'll notice that the period of time between these events is decreasing over time. What does it look like? What is a publishing model, you know, sort of following this Austrian school of thought where competition is a good thing? What does the publishing model look like in a world where there's so much content? And where do aggregators, platforms, where does all that fit in? Where does that leave us?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that there's going to be an ever better need for publishing platforms, even though we can all put out our material straight onto the internet. So much of monetization or being able to, you know, make your filmmaking sustainable, so much of that depends on wide viewership and all of that. Now, if you're going on YouTube these days and you have hundreds of thousands of clips to choose from, how do you know what's going to be good? I would say that these days time, more than ever before, is becoming the most valuable resource. It isn't our money, it isn't the amount we pay for something. It's knowing that if I watch 2 hours of a film, am I going to get those 2 hours back? You know, is that going to be a complete waste of my time? Even 10 minutes these days, our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. Investing 10 minutes in a clip, no way. People will click on something that's 2 minutes long, then they're done. And if they're not captured in the first 14 seconds, then they're out of there. So when you have aggregators that have a brand that you can trust, then that's a fantastic tool for viewers. So, I mean, HBO is great. They completely reinvented television. They're a platform that was outside of the main stations, and they redefined what television was. They made it this long-form, epic format that was basically like a super long feature film, and people were happy to watch a series because they knew that the quality would be high. If HBO is pumping that out and advertising it, then it's probably worth watching. And you're going to see that happen with all kinds of different platforms on the internet.
So, Naomi, don't you feel, though, that with even aggregators, that there's sort of a competition in philosophy where if we have these larger companies like HBO or even Netflix, which is really revolutionizing how content is distributed, mm-hmm. right? Like, don't you feel that, you know, there's some sort of difference between the decentral philosophy and having these central aggregators?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what I like is that there are no barriers to entry. So people do recognize good quality when they see it. Now, getting them to actually watch it in the first place can be an issue. But if you can get people to watch it in the first place, I mean, you can use social networks for that. You can use Kickstarter. That's something that's exciting about Kickstarter. You know, crowdfunding campaigns, again, they're a sort of peer-to-peer system for raising money for your film. Now, Kickstarter isn't about reaching out to people who don't know you. You know, you're never going to have someone just scrolling around on Kickstarter and say, oh, that's a project I want to give $50 to. I've never met this person, but, you know, I just want to give $50. You're not going to find it. Kickstarter is for raising money from your family and your friends. So, you know, if you can reach out to that network, and everyone has a network like that. Everyone has an immediate network. And if they like your stuff, then they will promote it. And that is the key. It's starting with the people, you know, in the direct network around you and leveraging those people and then getting your stuff out there. If your friends really like your stuff, they will pump it. If they don't like your stuff, then maybe you don't have a product that has enough value for people. Maybe it's never going to work, no matter how many eyeballs you get it in front of. So I think that aggregators are great. I don't think that they are a barrier to entry at all, and I think that if your content is good enough, then there are definitely ways that people will see it.
That's a great comment. And I did want to go. Hold on, sorry, James, go ahead. Okay, sorry about that. Hangouts lag always happens.
My question had to do with.
I guess I'll just go ahead. We are all eager to ask you questions. This is stuff we talk about
guys, take a number.
Yeah, we were in the chat, but I think what I wanted to say is that my history is in music, right? That's where I worked at 10 years ago, and I saw it, and I saw everything actually get much better for artists. Got much worse for labels, much worse for distribution methods, but it's way better now for artists, even with the Spotify model that gets all kinds of heat. And, you know, over the weekend, Eric and I actually had a chance to see Shooter Jennings here in Atlanta. He's someone who's became a great friend of mine because of his interest in Bitcoin. Shooter is a huge, huge fan of Bitcoin. I don't think there's anyone in any kind of entertainment field that I've seen that's as interested as him, with the exception of maybe Ashton Kutcher. But what I will say is he's such a rare exception from someone who gets this and gets the need for artists to control their distribution methods, it makes you see how so few others understand this. And they think Spotify is this big bad beast, when in reality, it's a platform that they should embrace more and use to reach out to their fans.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it is paying them, and yeah, maybe it isn't as much as they want, but it's a better alternative than people downloading it for free. The service is nice, and it's improved. I've seen everything improve in 10 years, and it's really, you know, it's really great. Music to me was the first one. It moved fastest besides, you know, print text and reading and, you know, reading materials. But it really is something that just, you know, artists don't seem to want to understand. And one of my other shocks when I worked at BitPay was the overall vibe at Warner Brothers Records, who were very forward-thinking about this stuff, surprisingly so. Mm-hmm. And I worked at a label about 10 years ago with a really large artist, really well-known one, and among others, and very not, like, just did not embrace anything close to the internet at the time. And you see how they evolve. They made their money, and Warner's making their money. But how do we really communicate this to artists? And, you know, the user interface is key, but really the messaging is even more key. And there needs to be a retaliatory message from the RIAA, MPAA folks that are so anti-decentralization because it threatens their business models. And how do we go about that? How do we get this messaging out to artists, you know, whatever art they make?
Right. I think that music, I mean, it's fascinating to me, and I used to be a huge fan of Napster when it was around, and I would download so much music, and I remember when, you know, they were being shut down, and I was, like, writing letters. I was, you know, a teenager in Australia. I was, like, writing letters to these US senators saying, don't touch Napster. Because it actually, I mean, it was an incredible resource for me. If I don't know a band, I'm not going to go and buy their album. I am probably going to try and find some of their content for free and listen to it. If I like their stuff, I'm probably going to download an album, right? I have to like it enough, though. Now, I think what happens when you have any sort of pirating platform that really takes off, that's a sign that there's some sort of market inefficiency. You know, it's not really working. Consumers aren't getting what they want. And what you saw happen was iTunes popped up around that time. You know, suddenly you could buy a song, a single song, for 99 cents. And that was incredible because I'm happy to buy a single song for 99 cents. It doesn't really seem that much. And if I like it, I'll buy it, you know. I'm also happy to experiment with songs by buying something and see if I like it because I'm not investing in an entire album. So you really did see the market come in and pick up the slack there. I'm still devastated Napster disappeared because, as you say, I mean, like, when you have free music platforms, what I found with Napster is it actually incentivized people to explore new types of music. You know, the emergence of the Napster stars, that was an incredible phenomenon. It was people who, you know, they hadn't been on the radio ever, they hadn't, you know, been discovered in any other way, they didn't have a label, but they were being discovered and had a huge Napster following, you know, that was incredible. Bands, there's a movie called Downloaded, I think it is, by the guy who was in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, actually, it's a good movie, and it interviews some of these Napster bands that emerged, and they'd go to this city they'd never been to before, and they'd, again, never been played on the radio. There's no reason why these people would know them. They'd go to a concert. They'd do, like, a small gig. And suddenly there'd be, like, a crowd filled with people who all knew the words to their songs. And it blew their minds. They were like, how did these people know the words to our songs? You know, there's been no outreach. How did we get out to them? And that's the decentralized method of peer-to-peer sharing. You know, I learned that someone on Napster, one of the users, has great music taste, so I start exploring the other things in their files. I start seeing what other music I might like, and I discover all this new music. And that incredible decentralization and the network of music that formed from that, you know, revolutionized music, and it changed forever after that. I think that we're going to see more and more of that in the film industry as well. You know, I think that the film industry is now like where music was 10 years ago. We're seeing more and more decentralization. We're seeing more and more like YouTube branding, you know. These days, when you were talking before about how do you know, how do you get your stuff out there if you're not on HBO or Netflix or one of these aggregators, you do it by creating a personal brand. And I think that, I mean, traditionally musicians didn't have to worry about marketing. They didn't have to worry about publicity. If you could get a record deal, they did that for you. And I think those, I mean, those were happy days, I guess, for people who didn't like the business side of things. But honestly, everything is a business. If you want your films to succeed, if you want your music to succeed, you have to build an incredible brand. And so much of this industry now is branding. And you see this with YouTube stars and their incredible branding. Now, you know, I can go to YouTube and I don't have to sift through a trillion different videos. If I know that there is a specific YouTube channel that I like that regularly produces content, I'll probably just subscribe to them and they'll tell me whenever a new thing comes up. So I think decentralization is fantastic. I think that, you know, more and more artists need to embrace it, but they also need to realize that it's an incredibly hard slog. They have to be business savvy. They have to put in so much more effort into the publicity and marketing and branding side of things, whereas before they might have wanted to just focus on their music. That's great, but you won't succeed in this world. You know, you can't just rest on your laurels and play good music and think that that's enough anymore, because it's just not. And I have a degree in classical music, so I'm around musicians who are very focused and they just practice their instruments, and that's fantastic. Incredible musicians, but honestly, they're not going to be the ones to succeed. They're not going to be the ones to really get ahead unless they can actually communicate to others that they are the best in their field, and they can't do that without incredible branding.
Yeah, so you're really touching on something about economics, really, and what I'd like to call applied economics. The whole concept of having the market forces rush in to fill a void, and that's why these piracy platforms exist. That's why they are so successful, is because there is a huge gap between what the current market offers and what the rest of the market desires, mm-hmm. right? So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you got into the economics. You sort of describe yourself as an economics evangelist, and what does that mean, and where'd you get it from?
What does that mean? It means that I am constantly butting heads with people who have these incredibly noble visions for policies they would like enacted in society. And Milton Friedman once said that you should never judge a policy by its intentions, judge it by its consequences. And I just kind of got really frazzled with dealing with these people. And you know what? Their hearts are in the right place. And we all want to change the world. We all want to make it better. We want to make people wealthier. We want to, you know, make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity, all of those things. But if you're enacting policies that just have terrible economic outcomes and you know zilch about economics and you don't realize all of the unintended consequences that will come from a policy like that, you are just going to destroy society. And we have had so many bad policies enacted, and all of these unintended consequences have flourished and people's lives have been destroyed. You try to help someone, you end up just enacting a policy that helps special interest groups. All of this stuff, I mean, it's really important that more people understand economics. I'm involved with a number of institutions that try to educate people about economics. I really can't stress enough how important it is. You know, I work with ManCal. I'm on their advisory council. So their Economic Education Foundation. I'm an alumni speaker for FEE, Foundation for Economic Education. I'm an alumni speaker for Atlas Network, which does a lot with economics. I host the Learn Liberty Academy. And, I work with the Moving Picture Institute, and we're all about freedom. So we do deal with economics, but really we deal with individual freedom, and that comes into play a lot with Austrian economics. So I fell madly in love with economics the more I learned about it. I studied economics at college and hated it, thought it was incredibly dry, wondered why I was doing this to myself. I must have been a masochist. And then I took a lot of time off from it, and then I sort of met my mentor, who's the economics editor at Barron's, Gene Epstein, and he basically gave me a reading list a mile long. You know, I saw him speak at a conference, and my mind was blown. All of the facts that he came up with in this conference, I'd never been exposed to anything like that. And he was saying things, and I was like, oh my goodness, I didn't even know that organization existed. I want to learn more about this. And so I met with him. He gave me a reading list a mile long, and I just read economic book after economics book after economics book. And from there, you know, I was caught. There was no getting out of it now. So it's something that very much works its way into all of the things that I do with my life. And it's very important to me, like through, I find Bitcoin to be a great tool for educating people about monetary policy. I find a lot of these great decentralized technologies we have these days to be a great tool to teach people about the economic structure that underpins it. Understanding economics is all around us. It helps us make good decisions in our everyday life, and it also helps us to fight for the right battles. You know, make sure that we're not just blindly, you know, smashing things and hoping we can make a difference. Let's actually get educated and let's get focused and understand how to make a difference.
I love what you just said, and I actually have two things to reply to that about that really are fascinating, because one of them is directly involved with a project that I'm now working on I accepted recently. But the first part is an article I read in New York Times yesterday or day before yesterday, basically questioning if economics is a pseudoscience. I love the article for one reason and one reason only, because it provided the point that why can't we admit we don't know things? Like, that is like the number one way to learn things, is admitting you don't know. And no one likes to do that, but in reality, those who do that usually end up ahead. That's just more of a human nature thing, but that's also going to segue into, Bitcoin did get me more into economics, absolutely. It got me into Hayek, a lot of his things made sense to me. You know, and the other step that happened when I joined this project, which is I got to meet someone named Robin Hanson. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but I had a background, an interest in Bayesian statistics, and his was more on this prediction market model of economics, a model I actually did not know much about. The more I studied it, the more I go, this makes a lot of sense. How come I'm not hearing about this until now? How come this is cast off to this weird little corner of the internet? And what are people doing to develop this? Because we have a model that has actually been somewhat proven, I don't want to say proven on a grand scale, but proven to be successful in a lot of different ways to make better decisions incentivized. And it's just something different and new. Just like Bitcoin, different and new, challenging norms. Doesn't that bother you, though, about economics and economic education, is that you can get so many different reading materials, and in the end, you really don't know what you read, and all you know is that some things made sense, some didn't. You research them more, and then maybe you can process that, but they're not really written for the average person. They're written for someone that is, you know, in academia, and quite often a blog could do a better job, which is why I think your job's so valuable. Is that a problem you see? And, you know, what are some other solutions that we can look at to make people more interested in economics?
Right. I'll start with the last question. So trying to make people more interested in economics is a difficult task. It's a very difficult task. I have two performance degrees, so it is probably a miracle that I ended up being so passionate about economics. It is not the expected career path for someone who's interested in the arts. That being said, people are interested in learning, and we shouldn't underestimate their ability to understand papers that are well written. I find that a lot of economics, it is just a bunch of... I just got like a random message pop up on my screen. Crazy Mac, where they, you know, link everything together. Centralized, not decentralized. So I think that there are ways that you can make economics fun. I know that you wanted to talk about the Bitcoin Girl music video. That for me sort of touched on some principles, like a finite supply of currency versus an inflationary currency. I think that if you can make fun ways to introduce people to ideas, make it digestible, then that will be how you get people interested in it. And people do want to know about this stuff, but they need to know why they want to know about it. So the key is to letting people know why it's important and why it matters, and how there are some tremendously bad policy decisions being made based on a flawed understanding of economics. So get people interested in that side of things. I think that the first part you said, when you're talking about it being a pseudoscience, I mean, economics is exactly what you said. You have a lot of central figures who are dealing with so many variables. It's incomprehensible how many different variables there are, and they think that they can centrally plan decision making. You know, when I choose whether or not I'm going to buy that juice, You know, there are so many things at play that determine this decision. You know, what's in the juice, how much it is, the distance to from my apartment to the juice, like all of these different things. So what makes a single person in the government think that they have enough knowledge to plan everyone's decision-making process in the economy? Why are they creating policies to price fix or determine these sorts of things? It blows my mind, and it always backfires, and it just does lead to so many unintended consequences. We definitely should not be viewing economics as this thing that we can predict. We should be allowing individuals to make their own economic decisions. Put as much power as we can into the individual's hands and take it away from central authorities, because, you know, there's always the risk that they will pander to special interest groups. There's always the risk of corruptibility. There's always the risk of, you know, just human mistakes. So why do we want to centralize all of that when we can disperse that, disperse the consequences of that, put it back to like an individual responsibility basis, rather than allowing a single person to say, oops, that was a mistake, but it's decimated the lives of hundreds of millions of people. I mean, it's just really bad decision making in my point of view.
Yeah, Naomi, I totally agree. I think sort of refocusing things on individual liberties and rights and freedoms is the only appropriate economic policy. And I think a lot of our guys believe the same thing. But I want to move on a little bit from economics and decentralization and talk to us a little bit about some of the other projects you're working on. Tell us about Subconscious. What's it about? When's it coming? Tell us where to find about it.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a great example of a decentralized sort of filmmaking process. We were a very low budget film, and we ended up doing very well. And that's, you know, the director of this film, Georgia Hilton, is incredible. You know, she has really taken advantage of all of the incredible consequences of the dispersion of technology, the democratization of technology. So our camera equipment was affordable now, because you can buy incredible camera equipment these days for a very low price. The visual effects software is incredible, so you just have to have the discipline to learn how to use it, and you can save a whole lot of money. So you no longer need to be a giant studio to make a fantastic film. And Georgia is probably the most disciplined and incredibly talented director I've ever worked with, and she just forged right through and taught herself everything there was to know about visual effects, and we came away with a film where we made, you know, three times our money, and we're a Lionsgate distributed film in North America. So that experience was just positive from start to finish. I'm working on a new film with her at the moment, which is really exciting, and that's also through the Moving Picture Institute. So that film, I mean, it's as I said, incredibly low budget. When you talk about the budget of films in Hollywood, again, Hollywood still has this mindset of what's a big budget, what's a low budget. So they'll refer to a micro-budget film as $4 to $5 million. We've made our film for a lot less than that, you know. I'm not sure whether I'm meant to give out numbers on the internet, so I won't, but it was a lot less than that, and we're distributed by Lionsgate, and the film looks fantastic, as I said, just because of the talent of the people involved. So yeah, that project was fantastic. Through the Moving Picture Institute, I have a ton of projects that I'm working on at the moment. Well, falling over. So that's exciting. You know, I'm working with Liberty.me. They're a fantastic platform, sort of like the Facebook of freedom-oriented people who believe in individual rights. Go to Liberty.me. It's a great place to learn things. When we talk about the democratization of knowledge, you know, you don't need to get a university degree anymore if you want to actually learn things. Go to a site like Liberty.me, and you have so much free content there, so many free books, free podcasts, interviews with professors. It's just a great platform for learning if you're an autodidact type of person. There's so many projects, I can't even keep track of them, but they're some of the big ones.
Okay, excellent. So we're going to wrap it up. Tell us where our viewers can find you, what should they look at, web addresses, social media. Give us your plug.
Right, my plug. Well, my Twitter handle is at Sky Corridors. I'm going to tell you where that came from. So, I mean, it's a bit random. It's not like at Naomi Brockwell or anything. That would be far too apt. But Sky Corridors, I just love, this is going to sound so ridiculous. You know, when the clouds in the sky, when like the sun breaks through them and it has these shafts of light coming down. It looks like they're, you know, corridors in the sky, and I just love that image. So that's where you can find me, at Sky Corridors. On Instagram, I'm the same name, at Sky Corridors. On Facebook, Naomi Brockwell. I think I'm the only Naomi Brockwell on the internet, which is kind of cool. On my, you know, I have several pages. I have RainsworthProductions.com, that's my production company. NaomiBrockwell.com, that's my page. I have my Liberty.me page, NaomiBrockwell.Liberty.me. That's probably where my content gets updated the most. So I have all of the clips from, you know, Stossel appearances, Independence appearances. I've been in the Wall Street Journal a few times. So you can find all of that stuff aggregated there. And yeah, Bitcoin Girl. .com is another thing, so bit.org, I mean. Lots of different places. I should be all over the internet, so you should be able to find me pretty easily.
Excellent. So, trivia. Those rays that you're describing, those sky corridors, they're known as crepuscular rays.
Ooh.
And I have to admire you, because I think your name is a little more poetic than the word crepuscular.
Crepuscular. I'm going to start doing that. My new Twitter handler, everyone, is at Crepuscular. it's going to catch on. It just rolls off the tongue. Crepuscular. It's going to be great.
Well, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a fantastic interview, and we hope to have you on again soon.
Super. Thank you so much, guys. Lovely chatting with you.